LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. From the North American Review, December 1907, chapters from my autobiography, chapter 25, the final one, by Mark Twain. Prefatory note, Mr. Clemens began to write his autobiography many years ago, and he continues to add to it day by day. It was his original intention to permit no publication of his memoirs until after his death, but after leaving Pier number 70, he concluded that a considerable portion might now suitably be given to the public. It is that portion garnered from the 250,000 of words already written, which will appear in this review during the present year. No part of the autobiography will be published in book form during the lifetime of the author. Editor M.A.R. January 11, 1906. Answer to a letter received this morning. Dear Mrs. H., I am forever your debtor for reminding me of that curious passage in my life during the first year or two after it happened. I could not bear to think of it. My pain and shame were so intense, and my sense of having been an imbecile so settled, established, and confirmed that I drove the episode entirely from my mind. And so all these 28 or 29 years, I have lived in the conviction that my performance at that time was coarse, vulgar, and destitute of humor. But your suggestion that you and your family found humor in it 28 years ago moved me to look into the matter. So I commissioned the Boston typewriter to delve among the Boston papers of that bygone time and send me a copy of it. It came this morning. If there is any vulgarity about it, I am not able to discover it. If it isn't innocently and ridiculously funny, I am no judge. I will see to it that you get a copy. Address of Samuel L. Clemens, Mark Twain. From a report of the dinner given by the publishers of the Atlantic. Started to get out. then, of the sort which nothing but death terminates. The seas were very bright people, and in every way charming and companionable. We were together a month or two in Venice, and several months in Rome afterwards, and one day that lamented break of mine was mentioned. And when I was on the point of lathering those people for bringing it to my mind, when I had gotten the memory of it almost squelched, I perceived with joy that the seas were indignant about the way that my performance had been received in Boston. They poured out their opinions most freely and frankly about the frosty attitude of the people who were present at that performance, and about the Boston newspapers for the position they had taken in regard to the matter. That position was that I had been irreverent beyond belief, beyond imagination. Very well, I had accepted that as a fact for a year or two, and had been thoroughly miserable about it whenever I thought of it, which was not frequently, if I could help it. Whenever I thought of it, I wondered how I ever could have been inspired to do so unholy a thing. Well, the seas comforted me, but they did not persuade me to continue to think about the unhappy episode. I resisted that. I tried to get it out of my mind and let it die, and I succeeded until Mrs. H.'s letter came, and it had been a good 25 years since I had thought of that matter. When she said that the thing was funny, I wondered if possibly she might be right. At any rate, my curiosity was aroused, and I wrote to Boston and got the whole thing copied as above set forth. I vaguely remember some of the details of that gathering. Dimly, I can see 100 people. No, perhaps 50, shadowy figures sitting at tables, feeding, ghosts now to me, and nameless forevermore. I don't know who they were, but I can very distinctly see, seated at the grand table and facing the rest of us, Mr. Emerson, supernaturally grave, smiling, Mr. Whittier, grave, lovely, his beautiful spirit shining out of his face, Mr. Longfellow, with his silken white hair and his benignant face, Dr. Oliver Wendell Holmes, flashing the smiles and affection of all good fellowship everywhere like the rose diamond whose facets are being turned we'll say the first 200 were injured by speech. I was expecting no returns from that part of the speech, but this was not the case as regarding the rest of it. Arrived now at the dialogue, the old miner said, "You are the fourth. I'm going to move." "The fourth what?" said I. He answered, "The fourth. He would stop facing those awful deities, facing those other people, those strangers, facing human beings for the first time in his life with a speech to utter. No doubt it was well packed away in his memory. No doubt it was fresh and usable. There was no help for this calamity, this shipwreck, this cataclysm. That this was the most disastrous thing that had ever happened in anybody's history. And then he added, "That is for you. And consider what you have done for Bishop. It is bad enough in your case. You deserve to suffer. You have committed this crime, and you deserve to have all you are going to get. But here is an innocent man. Bishop, I've never done you any harm. See what you have done to him. He can never hold his head up again. The world can never look upon Bishop as being a live person. He is a corpse." That is the history of that episode of 28 years ago, which pretty nearly killed me with a shame during that first year or two whenever it forced its way into my mind. Now, then, I take that speech up and examine it. As I said, it arrived this morning from Boston. Twice, unless I am an idiot, it hasn't a single defect in it from the first words to the last. It is just as good can be. It is smart, it is saturated with humor. There isn't a suggestion of coarseness or vulgarity in it anywhere. What could have been the matter with that house? It is incredible that they didn't shout with laughter, and those deities, the loudest of up there to keep me in bread and butter while I should write the book. I came across William Clinton, brother of the astronomer, and together we invented a scheme for our mutual sustenance. We became the fathers and originators of what is a common feature in the newspaper world now, the syndicate. We became the old original first newspaper syndicate on the planet. It was on a small scale, but that is usual with untried enterprises. We had 12 journals on our list. They were all weeklies, all obscure and poor, and all scattered far away among the back settlements. It was a proud thing for those little newspapers to have a Washington correspondence, and a fortunate thing for us that they felt in that way about it. Each of the 12 took 2 letters a week from us at $1 per letter. Each of us wrote 1 letter per week and sent off 6 duplicates of it to these benefactors, thus acquiring $24 a week to live on, which was all we needed in our cheap and comfort quarters. Clinton is one of the dearest and loveliest human beings I have ever known, and we led a charmed existence together in a contentment which knew no bounds. Clinton was refined by nature and breeding. He was a gentleman by nature and breeding. He was highly educated. He was of a beautiful spirit. He was pure in heart and speech. He was a Scotchman and a Presbyterian. A Presbyterian of the old and genuine school, being honest and sincere in his religion and loving it and finding serenity and peace in it. He hadn't a vice, unless a large and grateful sympathy with Scotch whiskey may be called by that name. I didn't regard it as a vice, because he was a Scotchman, and Scotch whiskey to a Scotchman is as innocent as milk is to the rest of the human race. In Clinton's case, it was a virtue and not an economical one. $24 a week would really have been riches to us if we hadn't had to support that jug. Because of the jug, we were always sailing pretty close to the wind. Any tardiness in the arrival of any part of our income was sure to cause us some inconvenience. I remember a time when a shortage occurred. We had to have $3, and we had to have it before the close of the day. I don't know now how we happened to want all that money at one time. I also and I